Foy Short, A Life in Southern Africa, Chapter 5, Back to Bulawayo. While in Gwelo, Foy always maintained ties with brethren in Bulawayo, especially at Queen's Park, his old stomping grounds. In the late 1970s, brethren at Queen's Park became concerned about the influences of institutional brethren from northeastern Rhodesia who wanted to have more control in Bulawayo. They asked Foy to come help them. Foy was disinclined to move away from Gwelo, but felt that Queen's Park needed him. So he and Margaret rented a small apartment in Bulawayo, and for 3 years, 1976 through 1979, constantly traveled the 100 miles back and forth between the two cities. He went to Bulawayo on Wednesday afternoons to teach their midweek class and also preached there on Sunday evenings, returning to Gwelo for the evening service. Gwelo had their Bible study on Tuesday nights, so he was able to be with both congregations for their midweek studies. Margaret said of their constant commuting, "By that time, cars were a bit better. We brought a car from New York and then a little Citroën to ship down. We used the Citroën because it was very economical. On most Fridays, Margaret would ride the bus to Bulawayo. Two young evangelists whom Foy had trained, Donald Hadfield and Paul Fudge, worked with the church in Gwelo, making Foy feel more comfortable about dedicating more time to Bulawayo. Foy studied 3 mornings a week with Hadfield and Fudge. During this period, Foy and Margaret also made fairly regular trips to Salisbury to help Jim work with the Greendale congregation that Jim had started in 1976. Foy, who was always close to his children, expressed on several occasions his joy at being able to work in the gospel with his son Jim. Jim preached 7 years in Zimbabwe from February of 1975 to January of 1982. Since then, he's made 7 trips back, the last one in 2006. He plans to return in 2012 and eventually move there with Carol when he can live off of his retirement income. Finally, Foy and Margaret decided to sell their house in Gwelo and move back permanently to Bulawayo. They begin to transfer a few small things gradually from Gwelo, first to the small apartment they rented, and then later to a small home they rented from their old friend Leonard Bailey in Queen's Park. Finally, a moving company transferred all of their furniture. After moving to Bulawayo, the Shorts continued returning a few days each month to the office where Foy's printing work was done. Enoch Newby stayed on and worked in that office every day while continuing to work with the African brethren in the area. Foy and Margaret first bought a small 2-bedroom house in the north end of Bulawayo. They lived in it from 1979 to 1981 and then bought another house on 6 Rockcliffe Road in Morningside near the meeting place of the congregation in Hillside. By then, many Zimbabweans of European descent were already beginning to leave the country, and this helped Foy and Margaret buy the house at a bargain price. Margaret said, "It was in a better part of town where property values were higher, and it was a much larger house with a large separate building with double garage doors, a carpet with pit for working on cars, which Foy used a lot. The property also had another fairly large building with a workshop on one side and 2 rooms and a half bath on the other." Margaret said, quote, "It also had a lovely established garden with lovely trees, shrubs, etc. That large double garage had a large table with a train track for an electric train set which hoisted up to the ceiling when not in use. Our grandsons had a ball with that when they visited, and we bought more engines and cars for it almost every time we were in South Africa. We brought it over here with us, and Jim's son is putting it up in a room in his house in California." Close quote. As Foy was getting back into the work in Bulawayo, he wrote to Dave and Ellen Bays that he and Margaret had not yet started to focus on evangelizing the lost, but rather were concentrating on building up enthusiasm among the faithful ones and trying to restore those who have fallen away. His reports mention several visiting preachers from other countries in the latter 1970s who helped encourage the brethren. Martin Broadwell, Marty Broadwell, Sewell Hall, Paul Williams, Ray Votaw, Jim Lovell, Gene Tope, and Theodore Chaddy. Not only did Foy and Margaret feel that their presence was more needed in Bulawayo because of the work, but also because they would be closer to his elderly parents, William Newton, W.N., and Delia. Foy's sister, Sybil, whose husband, Benelie Fudge, died in the early 1970s, came to Bulawayo in February of 1976 to help with her parents. Her sister, Beth, also spent time there. Delia's mind was beginning to be affected by old age in the latter 1970s, and she had a difficult time functioning. Foy's father became increasingly weak and unable to tend to his wife. Finally, Will Short, the old pioneer evangelist, passed away suddenly in June of 1980, leaving Delia, whose dementia did not allow her to function. Sybil said she couldn't even swallow. She didn't know what to do with food in her mouth. When Delia was younger, her brother George suffered from dementia and was placed in Cordell Christian Home in Cordell, Oklahoma. She said at that time that if she were ever in that condition, she would want to be taken there as well. After her husband's death, her children granted her request. She left Africa for the last time in December of 1980 for Cordell and passed away there almost 18 months later. Will and Delia always said they wanted to be buried in Africa. However, Delia's departure to pass her final days in Cordell, Oklahoma, complicated that wish. The family decided that cremation was the answer. Margaret said, "The funeral director said he would keep Daddy Short's ashes until hers were sent back. I took them back as part of my hand luggage on the next trip I made after she died, and they were placed together in the Wall of Remembrance at the Garden of Rest in Bulawayo." Changes after independence, 1980. Zimbabwe celebrated its complete independence from the United Kingdom on April the 18th, 1980, with a large ceremony in Rufaro Stadium in Salisbury, attended by Charles, Prince of Wales, and a host of other political dignitaries. Musicians Bob Marley and Stevie Wonder performed new songs that they had written for the occasion. According to Margaret, the situation during the first year after Zimbabwe's independence wasn't too bad. The Shorts even started their camp again for 1 year in 1981. However, political instability began to rear its ugly head again, with elements of Robert Mugabe's forces roaming the countryside to terrorize and kill. Mugabe, the elected president, formed what he called the 5th Brigade, composed of revolutionaries from East Africa and North Korea. These insurgents went into rural areas terrorizing Africans who Mugabe feared might be potential political enemies, particularly Matabele, who might sympathize with his political rival, Joshua Nkomo. When the ruthless 5th Brigade was on the loose in Matabele land in 1980s, no one could go into the countryside. Foy said, "The stories that were coming out of the rural areas were horrible. Families would have sons and brothers taken off and beaten, or more often simply disappear. It was a terrible time." Many bodies were thrown into old mine shafts that became mass graves. Margaret said, "By 82, it wasn't safe to go camping. A year or two after that, they burned the chapel and facilities down at camp. It had to be men from the Shona tribe because the owner was so respected among the Amandebele." 2 weeks after Foy visited his close friend Telly Moyo in Siwase, Political dissidents raided the town with the Zimbabwean army hot on their heels. Some villagers were killed in the ensuing turmoil. A number of brethren were beaten, but thankfully none died. The dissidents demanded food, which was unlawful to give them. But Telemojo told Foy, "What could we do? They had guns." Elements of Mugabe's army took their frustrations out on Europeans as well. A group of tourists from England stopped by the side of the road and were murdered. Though there were many rumors that the culprits were Mugabe's forces, no one was ever accused of the crime. Two of Foy and Margaret's grandchildren visited them in 1984. She and Foy took them to see Victoria Falls, but had a flat tire on the way and had to stop by the side of the road. A European man stopped to help the Shorts and encouraged them to get on their way as soon as possible. Shortly before, some people had been murdered on the same stretch of road. Foy began to limit his visits to brethren in rural areas again because of the raids in the country. He would rely on the word of his Nathabele brethren to determine whether it was safe to travel or not. On one occasion, brethren in a certain area gave him the green light to visit them. However, after arriving with seven Nathabele brethren from Bulawayo, the locals told him that they had just received reports of terrorist forces in the area. It was late in the afternoon when he arrived, and he and the others decided that it would be safer to spend the night in the danger zone than to drive back to Bulawayo at night, which would have been even riskier. Foy explained, quote, "Usually on these trips, the Africans who went with me would accept invitations to sleep in the huts in the village. I would have my tent set up just outside the village. On this occasion, when I set up my tent, the African brethren began to lay out their blankets around my tent. I asked them, 'Why is this? Why aren't you sleeping with your friends?' They said, 'Brother Short, there could be trouble tonight. If there is, we want to be around you.'" Close quote. Foy was very touched by the gesture of his brethren who took a risk by serving as bodyguards for him. More changes. The violence that followed independence and other signs of increasing destabilization in Zimbabwe made more people leave the country. The congregation at Queen's Park needed to make some adjustments as the neighborhood around the building emptied of English-speaking people of European descent and began to fill up with those of African ancestry who preferred services in their native language. The congregation invited Jeffrey Nyembezi to come and work in the Isindebele language. Finally, the English-speaking Christians decided to begin worshiping in English at the Hillside congregation where Foy's father had been an elder and turned the Queen's Park building over to the Nathabele brethren. The Hillside Church also had services in Isindebele in the afternoon. Foy worked with both while continuing to dedicate much of his time to rural churches. After Jim's departure in January of 1982, he also went once a month to Harare, ex-Salisbury. In the past few years, the congregation there has been meeting in homes. Thankfully, the tribal and political violence began to ease in the middle and late 1980s as Mugabe consolidated his control over the country. However, the stage had been set up for the coming economic crisis and famine. As the economy began to deteriorate, prices for food and goods began to escalate. Foy and Margaret began to make trips to South Africa for supplies. When returning, they had to deal with customs agents at the border between the two countries, but these were often so overwhelmed at the number of people who were returning to the country that they didn't have time to hassle them much. Margaret said, "There were times when some would try to give you a hard time, especially the women. We would be in a long line. When my turn came and I saw that I would have to go to a woman, I would say to the person behind me, 'You go ahead. I'm not in a hurry.'" Work in rural areas. Foy and those he taught continued to work among the Amandabele in rural areas in the 1980s and 1990s. Foy made frequent trips into the villages, taking dedicated African evangelists with him. When visiting Zimbabwe in 2010, Ellen Bays asked several of them about their experiences with her father. She wrote, "Big Boy Dube and Stanley Sithole told me how Dad used to pick them up and take them out to the villages, leaving two at each place while he went to the furthest village. When he finished preaching, he'd come back and pick them up. Stanley and the others from Bulawayo would meet him at Mike's garage in downtown Bulawayo. He picked up Big Boy Dube in Gwanda and others along the main roads to his final destination." When Telly Moyo passed away in late 2002, Foy reminisced about the work of that spiritual giant. He told about meeting Moyo when the latter worked at a hotel on the primary road between Bulawayo and South Africa. Later, Moyo worked in construction while preaching and teaching in his spare time in the area around his home congregation in Safila. That congregation grew to have about 100 members. He started a number of other congregations around Safila. In his next report, Foy told about a letter he received from Telly Moyo informing him matter-of-factly about a new work that he was helping in Nyamimi. When Foy began to think of the distances involved, he realized what a sacrifice Moyo was making to help the brethren, though his effort was not even hinted at in his letter. Foy wrote, quote, "From Safila to Nyamimi is about 30 miles, which meant a 60-mile round trip every week by bicycle. It was heavy going over paths with deep sand. It would take from 3 to 4 hours of difficult cycling." Close quote. He continued, We visiting preachers see all the results, but how many of us think of the hardships endured, the burning zeal motivating it all? After mentioning the efforts of Telly Moyo, he said, "In all the years I was privileged to work with Telly, he never indicated he thought he should be on American support." Newman Gumbo was baptized when he was 14 years old in the 1950s. He studied first with Jimmy Klassen and then worked and studied extensively with Foy during the 1980s and early 1990s. He was offered a lucrative job driving trucks in South Africa, but Foy and Margaret begged him to stay in Bulawayo. His continued presence was critical for their own efforts in drought relief, since he was Foy's right-hand man in the distribution of help to the needy congregations. After talking with Foy and Margaret, Newman's wife, Lillian, told her husband that she had a request and did not want him to disappoint her and say no. Then she asked for him to stay and preach in Bulawayo instead of taking the job in South Africa. Gumbo told her that if he did this, they would not have as much money to buy things for their family. She said that the Lord would provide. They stayed in Bulawayo and have been stalwarts in the Lord's work there ever since. Ellen Bay said of Lillian, "She's worked hard at home all these years since to help supplement his income, raising chicken, milk cows, and crops. I've never seen her without a smile on her face." Foy reported in 1978, "Brother Nyembezi reports 15 baptisms recently in the Gwanda area, 100 miles south of Bulawayo. There are about 20 congregations in that rather large area. Brother Nungoro reports 5 baptisms in the Midlands area of Rhodesia. The Gwelo Church is paying his expenses for a 10-day preaching trip in the Hartley Selous area." Though many congregations survived the Bush War, others did not. Foy gave a long list of places where churches were scattered in the war years: Dendenle, Machuchuda, Hartley, Sirawe, Danangombe, Negwande, Dolo, Siwase, Dadata, etc., etc. Foy was determined to either visit these places personally or find others who could. He added ruefully, "If only there were another full-time preacher here to help answering all these calls." For a number of years, Foy was the only known full-time preacher in the country who understood the dangerous leavening influence of institutionalism. Several subsequent reports documented his efforts to travel to these towns and villages with varying results. By 1983, drought and famine were becoming an increasing problem in rural areas. Foy's report of August 31, 1983, relates for the first time his efforts to take 100-pound bags of mealy meal on his visits into rural areas. Margaret commented on the drought situation, which would become increasingly severe in the coming years. Quote, "Matabeleland, being nearer the desert, was much more prone to drought than the eastern part of the country. There was not as much grain grown there, but there were many cattle ranches. There was always plenty of grain grown in the eastern districts, and, under the previous government, there was enough to keep a good reserve as well as export some. It was called the bread basket of Africa. After Mugabe took over the farms, it changed into beggar nation, having to import much of its grain. Some years, even before we left, there was not enough in the country, and though the government confiscated most of the grain that was given to them by the U.S. and others, we usually managed to get some from the milling company to take out instead of cash as before. During the last years, they have had to take the meal up from South Africa. For a long time, they only expected a severe drought about every 7 years. But then in the 80s, they started coming more often. And in fact, since then, there have only been a few good years." Close quote. More information about drought relief will be placed in the last chapter. In 1984, the church in Dolo invited brethren from the area to a 5-day Bible study session with Foy, Jeffrey Nyembezi, and Enoch Nube doing the teaching. Over 200 brethren attended, but the studies weren't given without incident. Foy said that about 20 minutes into his Friday evening service, thudding drumbeats began to drown him out. Quote, "To hear drumbeats in an African night is commonplace. I hadn't noticed them at first. Then, as they gradually grew louder, I still paid no attention to them. But suddenly, they were right outside the little meeting house, and I had to notice them. I stopped and asked the men what was happening. About that time, one who had stepped outside returned to tell us that a large number of the local Mazoni church had arrived, and I might add, arrived with a flourish. The meeting house was already crammed full, so it was decided to move outside to continue the service. It was also felt wise for me to shift my lesson from the work of the church to the work of the Holy Spirit. So, all changes being duly effected, we settled down to nearly 2 hours of preaching, followed by 2.5 hours of questions." Close quote. Foy then explained that the Mazoni were an offshoot of Pentecostalism, mixing traditional Pentecostal teaching about demon possession and miraculous power with African elements such as African-style dancing and drumming. The brethren were obviously glad to receive their visit in spite of their late and noisy arrival. Besides Teli Moyo, Foy mentioned men like David Nlovu, Newman Gumbo, Nyuati Nlovu, Obert Sibanda, Mountbatten Brewer, Joel Moyo, and Enoch Nube as being especially busy in preaching the gospel in Matabeleland in the 1990s. Sister Dlamini. Foy always expressed great admiration for the Christian women of Zimbabwe, who he believed often held many congregations together while men were either away working or sometimes showing less spiritual strength. One godly woman who he especially admired was Sister Dlamini, who he felt represented hundreds of godly Matabele women. He wrote in May 2002, "She was baptized by Brother Makosi Nlovu, who started the church in Dolo about 1950 or 1951. After marriage, she moved to the village of Mukai, about 20 miles from Dolo, where she began talking with her neighbors about the gospel. When the time was right, she invited Brother Nlovu to her village, where he baptized several and started a congregation. She was responsible for the establishment of the congregation and was a pillar in it throughout her life. Her son grew up and began to preach." Foy continued, quote, "I met her near the end of her life, when she was blind and cruelly afflicted with arthritis, her fingers so bent she could not hold anything, her legs and feet so crippled she had to be carried everywhere. But during the hour, some African brethren and I spent singing and praying with her, she uttered not one word of complaint. She sang many songs by heart and spoke with joy about the coming of the gospel to her village." Close quote. When reminded of Sister Dlamini in 2011, Foy and Margaret recalled a few more details about her. When hearing that Foy was in the area, she said that she wanted to see the white man. When he went in to see her, he realized that her bed was simply a couple of thin blankets on the floor. He also remembered the particular song she asked him to sing, which translated means, "Son of David, have mercy on me," said the blind person as Jesus was passing by. The song had several verses, and she sang every word from memory with a surprisingly strong voice. Crisis about buildings in 1991. In 1991, Foy faced a stressful crisis that almost cost faithful brethren the use of the buildings in Bulawayo that they had built and used for God's service for many years. The strain of the battle may have contributed to the heart attack he suffered as the problems were winding down. Margaret said that the discouragement they felt in this predicament was the worst they suffered in all their years of working in Africa. The problems could be attributed in part to the growing political destabilization in the country, and the fact that the rule of law was gradually being replaced with cronyism and party favoritism. Disputes were often resolved not on the basis of judicial impartiality, but rather on friendships or family connections in the government. The trouble began one Sunday morning at Queen's Park when a young man who had the keys to the building was assaulted by a group of men who tried to take the keys away from him. Thankfully, enough brethren had already arrived for services to intervene and keep them from taking the keys. Foy knew nothing about what was going on because at the time he taught a class in English at Hillside before coming to Queen's Park for services in Sindibele at 11 a.m. By the time he arrived, the brethren had called the police. Margaret said that Edwin Moyo, who was not related to the evangelist Telly Moyo nor Nesu Moyo, was one of the primary troublemakers. He had attended a college run by institutional brethren in the States, though Foy didn't blame the college for his actions. Jim Short opined that Michael Charles was the real person behind it all. Others, including Austin Vimba and Gabriel Gasella, helped in the plot. Charles had been a member of the church at Pattonhurst and had control of that building. He and the others, however, weren't content with controlling Pattonhurst. Foy said their aim was to take over everything. According to Foy, the men hoped to gain control of the buildings, especially Queen's Park, which was the largest, and become the official representatives of the Church of Christ before the government. Then they would have power over the property and also control who could come in and out of the country in the church's name. Foy said that they were gloating over the fact that when they got control, that building would be large enough for all their combined gatherings. To complicate matters, Edwin Moyo had close friends in the police department and could count on their support to harass Foy and other faithful brethren who had worked so hard with the congregations through the years. One tactic they used against Foy was to complain about the fact that he discouraged the support of Native African preachers by American churches. Jim Short believed that the group tried, quote, to use Dad's convictions about American support to accuse him of racism in order to have the government deport him so that he could no longer oppose their plans and continue his teaching about the dangers of institutionalism and centralized control. Close quote. Edwin Moyo's friends in the police department started harassing the leaders of the congregation at Queen's Park in Bellevue, taking them into custody and holding them at the police headquarters with no real basis. One faithful brother who was forced to go to the police station for interrogation was Mountbatten Brewer, whose wife was expecting their third child. Margaret took care of her and consoled her while her husband was in police custody. When the baby girl was born, she and her husband named her Margaret, much to Margaret's pleasure. One ally that Foy and his brethren had in the crisis was an excellent lawyer of African descent, a Mr. Malangu of Lazarus and Sarif, who knew how to handle the police. He told Foy, "If they come for you, be sure to phone your consulate in Harare before you go anywhere with them." Afterwards, they were helped in part by a white lawyer named David Coulthard, later to become Minister of Education, Culture, and Sport in the Government of National Unity in 2008. One of the plotters forged a letter that was supposed to have been written on Foy's typewriter and turned it over to the police. The police then came to Foy's house, rummaged through his office and his papers. The policemen were of the Shona tribe, and as they searched his office, they conversed among themselves in the Shona language with no idea that Foy understood everything they said. Finally, they asked him to drive his car to the police station with a policeman accompanying him. They followed behind in their own vehicle. Following his lawyer's advice, Foy insisted on calling the American consulate and his lawyer before leaving. While driving to the station, Foy began to speak in Shona with the policeman riding with him. When he arrived, several other policemen started grilling him about why he discouraged American support of Native preachers. Foy tried to explain his opinion with an illustration. He said, "If you have a child who is learning to walk, but you carry him all the time, he'll never learn to walk." As his inquisitors kept on quizzing him, Foy repeated the story several times until one of them said, "We don't want to hear that story again." In between their questions, the policemen at the station conversed among themselves in Shona. Foy noticed that the policeman who accompanied him to the station was trying to find a discreet way to motion to his companions to let them know that Foy could understand them, but couldn't get the message across without being blatant. Finally, to their shock, Foy spoke up in the Shona language and said, "Don't you know that I understand everything you're saying?" After an uncomfortable moment of silence, the policeman laughed, said they would sort everything out, and told Foy he could leave. When reminded about the encounter in 2010, Foy laughed and said he would always remember the startled look on the face of the policeman when he spoke to them in Shona. The troublemakers tried to take their case to the governor of Matabeleland, hoping he would sympathize with their efforts to take control of the church buildings. The governor agreed to call Foy in. Foy asked for permission to bring some of his friends. The governor agreed, and when Foy's friends filed in, they completely filled the office. Only one, Dennis Clark, was white, and another was a personal friend of the governor's. The governor looked at Foy and said, "Well, Mr. Short, when you said you were going to bring your friends with you, I thought you would have about 1,000 white men, and I see they're all black, and one of them is my good friend." So, Michael Charles, Gabriel Gazella, Austin Vimba, Edwin Moyo, and their allies were not able to get the governor's help in their takeover attempt. Towards the end of the crisis, the Shorts received another call from the police at a station near Bellevue requesting that they go to the police station. When they entered, they saw a group of their accusers who had in their possession a check that had been intended for them for drought relief, but sent by mistake to the Shorts. After Foy sent the check to them, they accused him of altering it because after the dollar amount, the check writer had written, "And no 100s," in the style of American check writing. Foy said matter-of-factly, "That's the way all American checks are written." The police were convinced, but Gabriel Gazella, a man they described as vicious, followed them back to their car, pointing at them furiously. Margaret reported that later, when Foy was in hospital in Johannesburg, Gazella prayed for his death at least once in the service at Bellevue. Ironically, Gazella died about a year later from stomach cancer. The harassment and legal wrangling lasted 2 years until 1993. The final outcome was that Charles and his allies were able to gain control of the building at Bellevue and keep their control at Pattenhurst, but they were unsuccessful in gaining control of the ones in Queen's Park and Hillside. However, the battle took a heavy emotional and physical toll on Foy. Heart attack. Towards the end of the crisis with the group headed by Michael Charles, Foy began to feel ill. His daughter Ellen said, "Of course, Dad never says anything unless it's really bad. He was snappy. He had a headache." After a night of severe chest pains, he knew he needed to see a doctor. After indecision by doctors on Friday about how to treat Foy and a painful Friday night, by Saturday night the doctors established that he indeed suffered a heart attack and admitted him to the hospital. There he had a strong attack on Saturday night and was placed in intensive care. Foy spent a month at the Mater Dei Hospital in Bulawayo. Though doctors thought he was making progress, an American nurse told Margaret that he needed to go to Johannesburg where there were better facilities. Finally, the doctors agreed. His cardiologist said that he and his wife were going to Cape Town on vacation and therefore could accompany Foy on the plane to Johannesburg as was required by the airline since Foy was a stretcher patient. However, when Foy arrived at Mill Park Hospital in Johannesburg, he went into heart failure again, and the doctors almost lost him. According to Ellen, quote, "He said later that he had such difficulty breathing that he wanted to give up. He kept saying, 'I've got to see Margot one more time, one more time.' That may have pulled him through," close quote. Though Foy was not as stable as doctors would have liked for the open heart surgery, they decided that waiting for it any longer might cost him his life. They went ahead and operated on him, though Ellen hadn't arrived yet from the States. However, the Maydells and others were able to be with Margaret during the ordeal. Margaret recalled, "There was a small hospital on the hill just above the hospital, which was very convenient for me. I kept telling the family I was okay, but was really happy to see Ellen on Thursday. Harold was phoning me every day, as was one of the three children over here. The late Jay Johnson from Birmingham also phoned me regularly. We had so much support." Foy made it through the surgery and began a long, slow recovery. After he was discharged from the hospital, Margaret and Ellen stayed with him in the garage apartment of their close friend, Ray Votaw. The Votaws loaned Ellen one of their cars, so she was able to run errands for her parents. Margaret recalled, I had support from the church members in the area, especially the Maydells, Votals, Hadfields, and Fred Cluley, who had been baptized as a teenager in Bulawayo. Finally, Foy gained enough strength to return to Bulawayo. Dennis Clark drove his car to Johannesburg and then drove Foy and Margaret back to Bulawayo. When Margaret visited the States in the summer of 1993, Jim came to help his father in Bulawayo, and he gradually began to return to a teaching and preaching routine. Foy later recalled with great appreciation the financial help he received from brethren in the States. He explained, quote, "Because of the troubled political situation in Zimbabwe, we'd been unable to get medical insurance. The expensive heart surgery had to be paid for. But when word was received in the USA, there was such a prompt and generous response that our needs were provided. Such has ever been God's care over us, provided through loving Christians. I think gratefully of many individuals and churches who helped us at that time." Close quote. Margaret recalled, quote, "Robert Hall got in touch with Kay straight away about raising money to pay for it, and they kept me informed about what was in the bank, so I had enough every time I had to write another check for Les Maydell to deposit for me and bring me the rand." Close quote. Foy and Margaret always held a special place in their heart for Robert Hall because of his efforts to help them during this period of trial. Ellen remarked that payment for the operation wasn't as difficult as it would have been in the States, because, as she put it, the total cost of hospitalization and open heart surgery in South Africa at that time was only $30,000, not the hundreds of thousands it would have cost in the U.S. In the mid-1990s, Foy began to think of something that in the minds of others was unthinkable: leaving Zimbabwe. Paddy Kendallball had said, "He'll be the one to close the door on the building." Though Margaret in no way insisted on returning to the States and was quite happy to live the rest of her life in Zimbabwe and even be buried there, Jim felt that his father had her interest and his children's in making the decision to return. Jim said, "It was an expression of his love for his wife and family, and probably one of the hardest things he ever had to decide in his life." Foy also longed for a time to be able to work on a Bible concordance in the Ascendibeli language, along with commentaries and other study aids. A return to the States would give him the time needed for those tedious projects. Ellen said, "It was this thought that in some ways he could do more for the Zimbabwe work while living in the U.S. that made it possible for him to make the very difficult decision to return to live in the U.S. Though Margaret said that health wasn't the primary reason for the move, she's glad that it was made. She said, "In the intervening years, the health service has deteriorated a lot. I'm glad we're here." Final farewell. When disciples heard that the Shorts were moving to the States, they began to make plans for an unforgettable send-off. A date was chosen, and the news about a final farewell spread throughout Matabele land. Brethren began to gather in Bulawayo from the countryside. Many camped around the church building at Queen's Park, bringing animals to prepare for the big feast on the final day. Ellen said, "We were inundated with pottery, embroidery, and all kinds of gifts." Before the final services, several brethren took Jeffrey Nyembezi, who was in a wheelchair because of strokes, and Foy to an artist who did a special drawing of the two. Then they all went to the packed auditorium at Queen's Park for singing, prayers, and final messages. Jeffrey Nyembezi, Nyumangumbo, Nesu Moyo, Mountbatten Brewer, and Telly Moyo gave special lessons, recalling Foy's time among them and asking for God's blessings for the future. Ellen said, quote, "All who spoke, both black and white, Fricke Klassen and Dennis Clark, talked about Dad insisting on book, chapter, and verse. In fact, some called him Mr. BCV. Several of the people told Dave and me that we must take good care of Mother and Dad, or they would bring them back to Zimbabwe and take care of them. Close quote. After all the hymns had been sung, prayers said, tears shed, and a few days of final packing, there was nothing more to do than go to the airport, watch Foy and Margaret board the plane, and watch it take off. It is not difficult to imagine the nostalgia Foy must have felt as he watched the land he knew best disappearing into the haze. Though he would be back for visits, it would never be the same. An era had ended. God's work would continue among the Matabele without the permanent presence of one of its pioneers. End of chapter 5.